Hello and welcome back to another episode of Open Floor. I'm Andrew Sharp, and on the other line, Ben Golver. What's up, man?
Not too much, Andrew. I just need to issue a retraction right off the top. The last episode, yep. I said the high point of the Wizards season was going to be the For the Culture podium moment. I did not realize we were going to see ruthless, bloody Kelly-on-Kelly crime like we saw in Game 3. What a scene. And you were there. And I'm just so excited that we were able to get this call together in the immediate aftermath of the game, because I feel like I'm going to get the afterglow of like a title fight. I mean, you're basically at Caesar's Palace tonight, weren't you?
It's really worked out well, man. It's worked out well. We were previously scheduled to record on Thursday night. Did not realize what was going to transpire at the Verizon Center. And we've got a lot of great questions. We're going to hit every playoff topic. We're going to hit Lonzo Ball's shoes. We got some good nonsense to talk about. But let me warn everyone, we're probably going to open with 20 to 30 minutes of Celtics Wizards talk. I apologize in advance, but I have a lot of thoughts. We got a lot of questions about Isaiah. And I want to open with one question for you, Ben.
Bring it.
Why do we fall?
Why do we what?
Why do we fall?
I don't know. Why do we fall? This seems like a trick question. I don't get it.
We fall so that we can get back up and body check Kelly Olynyk.
Oh.
What a night. What a night, man. Oh, it was the best. We also have a question from Dakota who says, which is more impressive tonight, the 27-point victory or Kelly Oubre trucking the shit out of Kelly Olynyk? I'm going to answer both. The scene at Verizon Center, and the Wizards sort of celebrated as if it were a bigger win than it was. I mean, it's still like the Wizards are still down 2-1. It is what
that was a big win. That was a season saving win. I mean, let's be really honest about it. If they had lost, I was going to just dog you out on this podcast for about 2 hours straight. And honestly, I was prepared for you to call in sick tonight so that we'd have to schedule it for like tomorrow sometime in the mid afternoon once you've pulled yourself together from all the tears tonight. So this was a big win. You can go ahead and have the big win.
All right. Well, I appreciate it. So what did you think of the Oubre situation?
Well, it was a strange game all around. People didn't really notice, I don't think. But, you know, the Jonas Jerebko, Jan Mahinmi, little beef early. There was a little bit of a below-the-belt love tap from Jerebko there. I don't know if people caught that. I think that's why Mahinmi, responded as he did. And then clearly there was multiple screens that Oubre took exception to. I mean, it wasn't just that one screen, which I thought was awkward. I don't think it was dirty. It was awkward. But Olynyk's one of those guys who's just regularly just awkwardly doing things all over the court to piss people off. So I can understand maybe reputation factored in a little bit to Oubre's response there. Look, I'm going to hear the Celtics people who are going to say that was an incredibly dumb play by Oubre. I mean, he shouldn't have lost his cool like that. I'm generally not pro-violence either, and yet even I have a hard time kind of criticizing this one. I mean, if you're going to go out, that's a good way to go out.
I love it. I love it. I was fully expecting an accountability take from you and calling for a more responsible approach from Oubre. I completely supported his actions tonight, and I know that's, I mean, like, look, it was clearly stupid for him to react the way he did, but sometimes stupid is what it takes, man. You don't make history following the rules. And it was great watching him go after them. And like you said, like the Celtics are just full of sort of habitual line steppers. Like they're constantly pulling underhanded shit that's not like overtly illegal, but is clearly like it's in a gray area, and like they've got three or four guys who operate in that gray area, whether it's Marcus Smart, Olynyk, Jay Crowder is the same way. I mean, Rozier was getting into it with Jennings down the stretch, Jerebko. So I support a Wizards player snapping and sending a message. And I'm also glad that it was Oubre, because look, Oubre is not Draymond Green. So like they could survive a suspension if that's what it comes to. And that's why if it were John Wall losing his cool like that, then it really does, like, it hurts the whole team. It's not a great situation. And I completely understand people who are like, you got to be better than that. But Oubre, he's an energy guy, and he brought the energy tonight.
Well, look, you were lecturing us about process versus results the other day. And this was one of those situations where if the result had been different, I probably would have come down on him harder. Like, if he had somehow managed to cost the Wizards the game, or if whoever stepped into his role just was completely screwing them up. And, you know, clearly, his decision there, you know, stretched their already stretched depth. And that was a turning point. You know, I think I probably would have piled on here. So I'm admitting up front, I'm probably not applying a good standard here. I mean, his decision-making process was not good. But the fact that he got away with it and it didn't really cost them, at least tonight, I think that gives him a little bit of a pass. Now, there is this other question, though, which is he going to get suspended? And if he gets suspended, that's a real carryover effect. And if you're Boston, you probably take the split, and you don't feel too bad about Olynyk getting made look ridiculous. Also, by your point about all these line steppers, what are the odds that somebody flew backwards through the air 30 feet after getting shoved and it wasn't Marcus Smart? I mean, that is, not what I would have predicted if you had told me that this was going to play out. But do you think he's going to get suspended or no?
Yeah, I do think he'll get suspended. And when I said he's not Draymond Green, what I mean is that he's not going to swing a series, and they could survive without him. And as far as the suspension is concerned, I mean, I'm more curious. I still haven't really seen detailed replays. I'm sure the internet has gone full Zapruder on this, and particularly the Olynyk screen. So I'm not really sure what people know. From my seat, it was crazy just because I thought he pushed the ref, but it looks like there may have been some incidental contact with the ref, but it wasn't like the ref didn't get body checked also, which is a victory for anyone who doesn't want to see Oubre suspended into the 2020s. But as far as like his bearing on the series, I honestly think that the Wizards may be a little bit more dangerous with Boyan taking some of those minutes, and particularly if Mahinmi is going to be back healthy.
Yeah. That was a blessing that we didn't really see coming. And was there any buzz about him being back, or he just kind of showed up? Somebody said he was on an exercise bike. The next thing you know, he's in the game. I mean, that kind of seemed like it was a Superman arrival from Jan.
Yeah, well, it was funny. I had heard from a couple sources with the team that he might come back, and I didn't really give it much thought. And then in the pregame press availability, Brooks said he was a game time decision. And for me, when Mahinmi came back the first time, I think it was in maybe March, he played his first games of the season. He looked so wobbly, and just I was watching him saying, look, I don't know if I can watch this guy struggle to run for the next 4 years. But then he started to, after a couple weeks, he started to get his legs underneath him and started to, you could see why Grunfeld signed him over the summer. And because he protects the rim really well. He's decently mobile, and he makes a big difference, particularly for that second unit, which can't score or guard anybody, which is not a great combination. So, and I thought he made a big difference tonight, and gives them a look against this Celtics team that could be really helpful. And in terms of the game, I mean, there's only so much to take away from a 25 point blowout. I thought the two big differences for me were, number one, this game underscores how important Isaiah Thomas is, because if he's not incredible, basically if he's not Steph Curry East, then the Celtics are become really ordinary real quick. And then the second difference was Otto Porter showed up, made Isaiah work on defense. And as we talked about this series, I hadn't even really counted on Otto Porter because he's been such a non-factor for 2 months now. I was complaining about Beal. I was looking for more from Wall, but if Otto can be a factor, that changes things. And he was great tonight on because he also guarded Isaiah too.
Yeah, I mean, they asked Brad Stevens in the post-game press conference how it felt to have a mortal Isaiah Thomas. And once you've reached that level where like people are surprised by your mortality, that means you've really been on a hot streak. And Isaiah's been ridiculous for the last couple of weeks. He was off. All of their supporting shooters were off too. I mean, I'm not sure any of their guys, you know, go up and down the box score if any of those guys really shot the ball well from outside. And that's when they look terrible. I mean, that's how they looked, you know, early in that Chicago series as well. When those guys aren't helping at all and Isaiah's not, you know, extraordinary, it's a very beatable team. You know, what did you make of Stevens' kind of caution? You know, I mean, he was really playing up how lucky they were to win those first two games. I mean, it almost seems like he saw this coming a little bit, or maybe he's, you know, more nervous than most people are. I mean, you actually were kind of confident after game two. I was surprised. I was talking a lot of crap to you about it, and you were like, no, it's still a series. It's still a series. I mean, I guess you and Brad were in the same film session, huh?
Well, a little bit. I mean, before the game, Stevens came out and said, look, like, these guys, our guys are not going to get overconfident because we've all watched the film. And if you look at the film, like, the Wizards have won like 5 of 8 quarters. Now, I worry about the series in general because it's just things generally don't go well for the team that gives away winnable games. And like game two was super winnable for the Wizards and they gave it away. And like, I've watched them blow series against the Hawks and the Pacers that were winnable just because they don't execute quite as well as some smarter, older teams. And so that could totally be how this ends for the Wizards and Celtics. But I think Stevens understands that, like, talent wise, it's a wash at best if you're looking at it from the Celtics perspective. So yeah, like, it makes sense to be cautious from his side of things. Although the other factor, as the second half got out of hand tonight, I was kind of worried sitting there. I was like, you know, we don't need to be this disrespectful because an extra pissed off Celtics team on Sunday in game four could be tough to deal with.
Well, let me ask you this. Is this Celtics team punkable though? I mean, when the flashback to the funeral, I mean, there was a lot of talk both ways, right? And Washington came out and Boston really had no answer for them in that game. John Wall was talking to every single person on the court during game three, it seemed like, as was basically everyone. Brandon Jennings was going after Terry Rozier in one of the most off-brand, hilarious, head-to-head ejections that you'll ever see. I mean, do you feel like Washington still just thinks that they're a better team and they can prove it? I mean, that's kind of the vibe that I got. Like, it didn't seem like they were shaken at all by Isaiah's 53. I mean, Isaiah puts in 53 in game two, the most points we've seen in a playoff game since 2003. And these guys came out and just put it right on their chin.
I was shocked by how unfazed anyone on the Wizards was, even before the game. I mean, there was not, like, people weren't worried. And the old saying, a playoff series doesn't start until a road team wins a game.
Don't do that.
Yeah, I'm not going to do any of that. All right. The Wizards are still in a bad spot and I'm not going to get too high after the game. I just really did enjoy Oubre trucking Kelly Olynyk. That was cathartic for me.
You know, one thing I was going to say, it's been a real big thing about how LeBron's paying people's fines, you know, like Dante Jones. He's like, oh yeah, I'll take care of it. I was thinking
Kevin Love going to wire some money.
Oh my God. You read my mind. We're obviously spending too much time talking basketball together. You stole my punchline. I think Kevin Love should pay Oubre's fine. I think that should be a tweet and Instagram. Get about 1 million hits on a blog post. That'd be perfect.
I got an email from a Cavs fan friend during the game thanking me on behalf of Ohio. So everyone's on the same page on that one. One other note on Oubre that I liked, like, there's a GM. I talked to somebody for a Grantland piece a couple years ago, and there's a GM who evaluates draft prospects as pit bulls or poodles. Like, he'll say, is this guy a pit bull or is he a poodle? And this was explained to me in context because someone had said Kelly Oubre is a poodle, and like, he's kind of the ultimate poodle. And you know what? He was not a poodle tonight, or maybe he was an angry poodle, but he showed out, and it was a side that I was really not prepared for from him.
Look, even poodles can get rabies, man. Like he was hot. Like he went 0 to 100 real quick. I loved it. And I'm excited to see what happens in game four, because I think that was really the takeaway, is that if there was a game to quit, you know, if this was really going to be a grand opening, grand closing series, I mean, that was the night. After you don't get Bradley Beal game winner at the end of regulation, which was a great look, right, fell in his lap. He should have hit it. I mean, that's a heartbreaker. You know, you take 53 from Isaiah, and it's like, how do you even stop this guy? I mean, everybody's going nuts about where does he rank in NBA history after that performance. It's like, if there was a time to quit, that would have been it. And their answer was good, man.
Yeah. Well, now that I have annoyed every Celtics fan with my enthusiasm, let's talk a little bit about Isaiah, because his game the other night really was like out of this world, and his whole playoffs have been on that level generally, like with except for the first two games against the Bulls when he was clearly going through all kinds of stuff, and then tonight he was off. But just generally, he has kind of answered the bell like every step of the way. So we got a couple Isaiah questions, but they're generally along this line, the lines of this question. Leon says, Isaiah's ability to be effective in the playoffs was a huge question mark before this year, and I was definitely unsure about whether he'd carry over his regular season success. What do you think is allowing him to be as effective as he's been? For the record, I'm not trying to get you to eat crow. I'm genuinely curious about your take. What do you think?
Well, I think when you look back where he was 3 years ago to where he is now, he is like right at the front of the line in terms of beneficiaries for how small ball has changed the NBA, right? Like a player like him is absolutely benefiting from increased space and from having either zero or one defenders in the paint, right? Like I think what really opened them up in the Bulls series was taking Amir off, ensuring that there's always four out or sometimes five out, and just putting Isaiah in a situation where he's either going one-on-one in space going to the basket, or you know, he's attacking a paint where there's no defenders in there. I mean, he's an excellent finisher. That's been who he is. He's getting better and better at drawing calls, and he's getting more and more whistles. And he's got a great shooting stroke. I mean, that's always kind of been part of his game. I do think that he's looked better than, you know, his sort of average performance here these last couple of weeks. I'm not going to kill him for an off game in game three, just like, I mean, I might not celebrate him quite as much as some people did after game two. The Wizards didn't really pick on him until game three. I think that's been a flaw of both of their postseason performance opponents, whether it's Chicago or Washington. Like they haven't involved him enough on the defensive end to really make him pay and really make playing him hurt. You know, I still think like when you go against a team like Cleveland, who can put out lineups who basically they can't get Isaiah in a situation where he can hide. Again, that's going to limit his overall impact. But like, if you let him hide and you let him go one-on-one in space, Isaiah is an awesome player, and he's really showing that. But it's been an evolution. And I think, you know, if the NBA hadn't all gone to four and five out here over the last few years, maybe we never see this from him. But, you know, his season this year, his regular season was like hard and light. I mean, you look at the numbers, it was very, very similar. Obviously not quite as good playmaking, but the all-around scoring games are very similar in terms of how they get their points. And he stepped up and he's doing it in the postseason. And he has answered the questions. I mean, these were open questions. It wasn't like he was never going to answer them. And, you know, one comparison I do draw is like between him and DeMar DeRozan, like whose game is built better for the postseason? Like if you had to bank on one of those guys coming into the playoffs and having a big playoffs, would you have picked Isaiah, who's got the knockdown 3-point shot, who's got the one-on-one ability, who gets to the free throw line, who has this kind of complete all-around offensive game and a lot of spacing around him to make it work? Or would you have banked on DeRozan, who's very like one-dimensional, puts his head down, goes to the rim and takes a lot of tough mid-range twos? I'm not very surprised how this playoffs has played out with Isaiah thriving and DeRozan struggling. And those are two guys who, you know, kind of have consistently felt like they need to prove themselves. It goes back to the trend talk that we had earlier, you know, in terms of where's the game going, and, you know, boil it down right there between those two guys. I mean, who do you want your team built around? I think it's pretty clear.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm not going to let you hijack this and shift over to a discussion of DeMar DeRozan. I'm completely done with the Raptors. We may do 2 minutes on the Raptors on this podcast. But the thing with Isaiah that I think sets him apart is there really, like you mentioned, the way the league is changing, and that's completely true. But even now, there are still only a handful of guys who can consistently hit jumpers off the dribble. And yep. The ability to do that really, like, there's no good answer for him. I mean, I've been sitting here watching the Wizards. They have no answer except to trap him, and they trapped him more tonight, and it made a difference. But even then, I mean, he's so quick that you can only do so much. And coming off the pick and roll, the ability to pull up and hit, like, I mean, Steph can do that. Harden can do that. And I can't really think of many other guards who are doing that consistently.
Well, yeah, that's the kind of the Harden comparison comes in, because he'll step behind that screen and do it too. There, you know, Brad's really good about mixing in, you know, how he gets the ball, getting him on the move so he can attack with speed because he's so quick.
That's putting a really him in good
situation,
point.
Putting him in situations where he can get switches so he's not being guarded by, you know, your primary perimeter guard. I mean, that's another thing that, you know, Brad's good at. The trapping thing is an excellent point, though, because I think there's also a familiarity level there with Isaiah where he's now seen that. Like, that worked on him very well last year, right? Like, they were kind of flummoxed by it. And now he understands what the counters are, and the Celtics understand what the counters are. And, you know, here's another thing about the trapping working specifically in game three. If those supporting guys are hitting their threes, it's not going to work so well as a strategy. You can't go to it as regularly, right? So it's another situation where, you know, he has an off night in game three, but it's not all his fault. And it's also another contrast with DeRozan, where you trap him and he's worthless. You know, I mean, he gives you nothing. If you trap him, he's forced to pass the ball. He just stands around and the game over. You know, he's got no counter. So yeah, I think it's a combination of really smart basketball strategy, good personnel around him, improvement from him. And he gets a lot of calls now too, man. I think he's got that star status, you know?
Yeah, unquestionably. Anyone even breathes on Isaiah, he's getting a whistle, which is fine. You know, that's part of arriving as a superstar. The point about Stevens, like, I don't want to turn Isaiah into like a system quarterback, because he's better than that. And like, you mentioned it, like, his game has grown and become more efficient. Like, tonight is not the greatest example, but like the 53 on Tuesday, like, he just doesn't make mistakes. He is exploiting every screw up the defense makes. Having said that, though, he does have weaknesses, and you could not have paired him with a better coach in the NBA to sort of hide those weaknesses and accentuate his strengths. And I think that's what Stevens does so well with every player on that roster. And it's why, like, I understand people get tired of the hype with Brad Stevens, especially because the Celtics haven't really like won anything, but like, some of those guys have no business being as useful as they are. And even Isaiah, like, who is really good, unquestionably an all-star, is not, I'm not sure he would be Steph Curry light without Brad Stevens there to sort of maximize his strengths. So the other question, though, that I have is, like, if you're Boston, do you pay him? Because I talk to, like, every Celtics fan I know is kind of on the fence on that one.
Well, we did get a question from a guy named David, and he wanted to know, like, you know, he basically said he's torn between this idea that Isaiah is a folk hero because he's such an overachiever and he's so fun to watch and he's delivering, you know, further and further into the postseason this year. But then there's also this question of, like, is he your championship guy if he's your lead ball handler, you know, knowing the defensive limitations and knowing, you know, some of the holes that you talked about. How do you process that? Because eventually that's going to be a financial decision. So, I mean, I get what David's saying there. Like, it is hard to envision this championship roster where he's like a far and away the best player on the team. And, you know, like this current version of the Celtics where like he's asked to do so much. It's very hard to see this group winning a title, right? But I think you can't really put a price on that atmosphere in game two, right? Like 53 points, Garden's going crazy, selling thousands and thousands of jerseys. The fan base couldn't be happier or more delighted. I mean, that's the kind of thing that you don't want to watch walk out the door, right? And like, we're looking at all these other contract decisions, guys like Chris Paul with the Clippers, Kyle Lowry with the Raptors and a few of these other guys this summer, like those guys are probably better all around players. Although Isaiah is really racing up the board here, given how well he's performed on offense. But I mean, if you're really an organization, who's a harder guy to say no to, a harder guy not to pay, you know, like, isn't it harder not to pay Isaiah at this point? And maybe we wouldn't have said that 6 weeks ago, but he's made an unbelievable case that you got to keep this guy at, you know, no matter what the cost is here during this run.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of with you. I think like in a vacuum, it's easy to be skeptical and say that you're not going to build a title nucleus around him. But that's kind of unfair because like that question can follow him as long, like he's not going to be able to answer that question until he's actually like winning a title. And so the skeptics are always going to have that strike against him. And right now, I mean, you look at the next couple of years, like the Warriors are going to be in control of this regardless. And you're not necessarily forfeiting that much if you say, look, we're going to take our lottery picks and we are going to look toward the future and then also like have Isaiah here for the foreseeable future for the next 4 or 5 years. And he's going to be our rock to build around. Like that actually makes sense to me. And like you said, there are just certain things that he's pulled off that can't be quantified in terms of what they mean to a basketball team. And especially when the alternative, like there aren't any other clear alternatives to compete with the Warriors, and you're not necessarily forfeiting long-term building by keeping him around for the immediate future. So I guess I'm surprised that I am as pro Isaiah extension as I am, because it'll mean tough choices elsewhere. Like, I don't think you can pay Isaiah $200 million and then also pay Avery Bradley $80 million or $100 million or whatever he'll command. I think maybe keeping Isaiah means you have to look to move someone like Horford, particularly if they're trying to sign Hayward. Like, there are all kinds of questions, but Isaiah, like, even if he's a product to some degree of playing in a perfect system, like that system's not going anywhere. So it makes sense to me for the Celtics to keep him.
Look, I'm getting a little sick of the system talk too. Like, you know what systems do? They win basketball games. If your system is designed around an awesome ball handler who can get to the rim in the free throw line and shoot a three-pointer, and you've got a ton of shooters around him, guess what? That's an awesome system, and that's the only system you should be playing. It's hard to get another Isaiah. You know, if he can continue to play at this level for the next couple of years, they're going to be really good. I guess the way I would kind of boil this down, I'm not sure Boston's title hopes over the next 5 years depend as much on Isaiah as they do on how much superstar talent they can put around him, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
You're just going to have to pay for him. I mean, if he's going to play at this level, you're going to have to pay him a max. And so it's about finding a better number two guy than Al Horford. It's about finding, guys who are in their prime right now, not, you know, lottery picks for next year's draft, but guys who are ready to do it and support him and help him kind of carry the load and put together a real big three. That's what's going to determine whether they're actually going to be able to compete with Cleveland and Golden State, because those two teams are just on a ridiculous plane right now. And that's really been the lesson from the second round, is that the gap between very good teams, or what I've been calling cute stories, and the true elite teams here is massive. And it's bigger than we thought, because these teams did flip the switch. I mean, everybody who is worrying in March about Cleveland looks pretty funny right now. And yes, they're not perfect teams, but the gap there is gigantic, and it's bigger than we thought.
All right. Well, yeah, that's a good segue then. Let's transition into some Raptors-Cavs talk. Again, I'm willing to do exactly 2 minutes on the Raptors. Roman says, what do you think the Raptors are going to do this summer after going all in during the trade deadline and not being able to even have the Cavs take them seriously? I mean, what options do they have? So I don't know. Like, would you can't really, it's not really blowing it up to say we're not going to pay $250 million for Lowry and Ibaka. But if I were them watching this series, like, it may make sense to go a different direction.
It does. And if I only get 2 minutes to talk about this, I need to make sure that I get in my my main line, because DeMar DeRozan was offering $100 to anyone who could guard LeBron. And besides the fact that that's kind of sort of his job at some point during these games, I mean, Masai Ujiri offered somebody $26.5 million over the summer to be able to beat a trap and be a number one offensive option during the postseason. And he's still waiting to collect there, because that person that he paid is no showing right now. So,
Well, wait. Did DeRozan actually say that?
Yeah, you didn't see that? That was going around everywhere. He said he'd offer, you know, if anybody had an answer for LeBron, he'd give him $100.
Wow. $100 is cheap, man, for considering how desperate the Raptors should be right now. $100 is probably not enough.
Well, look, you couldn't pay me $100 to take a charge from LeBron, I'll tell you that much.
Yeah, you know, DeRozan has really been getting roasted, so I feel like we should be going easy on him. Somebody on Twitter called him a rich man's TJ Warren. No, they called him an older TJ Warren to me in my mentions. Oof. And like, it does not get more ruthless than downgrading an all-NBA player to old TJ Warren, but that's kind of where we are with this Raptors team.
Well, look, there is a Toronto media member who will remain nameless here. I'm not going to be taking shots, but I've received months worth of heat over the DeRozan talk from this person. And there was a give up moment. There was a moment of waving the white flag during game two where the tweet came out and it said, "You can't win with DeMar DeRozan in the playoffs." And there might have been a silent fist pump reading that tweet on this end. But look, when you're talking about the future of the Raptors, and to bring it back to the question here, you're talking about the future of the Raptors, to me, it starts with trading DeRozan. I mean, I know he's a great regular season player, master of the mid-range, really had it going in November, but that's a gigantic contract. If you have to choose between him and Lowry hasn't been great in this series either, but I'd still pick Lowry. And you have all these other contracts that you're trying to offload. You might find difficulty doing that, whether it's Jonas Valanciunas, Damari Carroll. You've probably got to pay Serge Ibaka. I mean, he's probably one of your top three players at this point. I think the best way to retool is to trade DeRozan and move forward, right?
No, I actually disagree. With due respect to your DeRozan crusade, your crusade against the mid-range, I think DeRozan is young enough so that you have to sort of run
really
it back
gonna improve
for a couple years. And well, yeah, no,
so you're
look,
really good. You're really going to expect major improvement here. Okay.
So you would choose 32-year-old Kyle Lowry making $30 million a year?
I don't love that either, but I would definitely choose not both. And then if my goal was to win, like, you know, in the immediate short term, like next season, and I had to make choices here, my choices would start with like Lowry and Ibaka. And I just think DeRozan's more replaceable. I got a guy in Norm Powell who's going to give you what, you know, 60 to 65% of what DeRozan can do. And he's a better defender. He plugs in. And you just have a better roster construction. You can trade DeRozan for, you know, multiple picks and a younger player, or however you want to put the contracts together. You get more flexible. That team's totally lost if they don't have Kyle Lowry. The drop off between Lowry and their other point guard options is significantly greater than the drop off between DeRozan and their other wing options.
Sure. But I think that the lesson of this series is that the goal should not be to win in the immediate term. Like the goal should not be let's take down the Cavs, because it's just not a realistic thing.
But Andrew, you're one of these internet guys who wants to blow up every single team. I mean, these teams are trying to milk these good seasons along. This is the golden era of the Raptors, right? Like, they're not just trying to have two good seasons and fade away into oblivion. Like, they want to be good for the next couple years.
Look, I'm saying that you can build around DeRozan to some degree and try to take some chances elsewhere. That's what I would do. Anyways, already too much Raptors talk.
Do we want to talk West or no?
Yeah, let's talk West real quick. Warren says Steph Curry is about to finish a 4-year, $44 million contract. Given what he's achieved the past 4 years and relative to the salary cap of the day, is this the best value contract in NBA history? I'm going to say probably not. I feel like some of the initial contracts, like Bill Russell, was probably getting like royally screwed in the old days. So he probably had better value, but it is a relevant point in any Warriors discussion that, like, the only thing that ever really made this possible was Steph getting like badly underpaid because of the ankle injuries.
Yeah, the guy's point is well taken in terms of how great of a value Steph is, but it really does a disservice to NBA history to make that kind of a claim. So when Michael Jordan averaged 37 points, 5 rebounds, and 4.6 assists in 1987, do you know what his salary was in 1987? Something yeah. around like $600,000, right? Like, so he was basically on a 10 day, like a modern day 10 day.
Yeah, exactly.
Pouring in 37 a night and thinking about how many shoes he was selling. I mean, and you can just go right down the list. I mean, MJ got the crazy balloon payout at the end of his year, but his average salary throughout the 90s when he was leading them to title after title was like $3 or $4 million. So you can adjust for inflation however you want to adjust for inflation. I don't think any of the guys, even guys on rookie deals in the modern day, are doing quite what, you know, the legends of the past did. And thankfully, the NBPA realized that and is kind of taking care of some of these guys with the health benefits and all that, because you know, it's insane where the salaries have gone.
Yeah. Another Warriors question real quick. Nicholas Nacho says, "Hi, Ben. I'm one of your podcast listeners all the way from Malaysia." Shout out Malaysia. He says, "Can you guys discuss Kerr's impact on the Warriors? What are your thoughts on them making it to the finals without their coach?" My initial thought is that the most fun version of the Warriors that we saw was the team playing those first 2 months without Kerr. They talked more trash. They were just like, the offense was kind of, it felt freer. So it's crazy to think that this, I don't want to say that it helps them without Kerr, but it is, I mean, I'm more excited for Warriors interviews, Warriors like fourth quarters. I think it'll be fun to watch this team try to navigate this. I don't think that they are better off, but I'm not worried about them.
Yeah, I mean, you love the substitute teacher Warriors for sure. Look, it's hard to say what the impact is going to be because they haven't been in a game that's been close. I mean, I think they've played 2 total minutes of crunch time, you know, games within 5 points in the last 5 minutes in the entire postseason. They've won basically every single game going away. I think one difference people have pointed out is Mike Brown's substitutions. He might get a little bit less creative. Like, he's not trying so hard to put the 14th guy in to, you know, keep his confidence going. Like, you know, the Steve Kerr's favorite trick, you know, making sure everybody gets a little look. But this team seems to me kind of like it's a self-governed operation. I mean, they're playing defense at such a high level and it's all coming from Draymond that the coaching at this point is still secondary. If they continue to lock down, like they did, especially late in game one against the Jazz, but also at times against the Blazers. I mean, that's sort of the coach's job, right? To like motivate and get guys going and playing hard. And this team's doing that, like, definitely. And that's not really a question at this point. And they're playing defense at a much higher level than any of the other contenders, Cleveland included. I mean, you look at the defensive rating. I mean, I think their last time I checked, they were like 5.5 points better defensively than Cleveland's been. So that's a huge gap.
Yeah.
And that's where I always look for, like, a talented team. That's where I always look first for impact of coaching, is like defensive effort. And their defensive effort is excellent, unparalleled at this point. So I'm not too worried about it.
They've got a couple, basically Draymond and Iguodala are like coaches on the floor. So that's a serious advantage in any of these conversations. And the one thing you mentioned, LeBron and his potential impact on the finals, I would say the issue there is that those shots from LeBron, like, the energy is going to be very different if he's down 9 and is watching the Warriors just like rack up 3 after 3 after 3. Suddenly that confidence may not be the same. So I wouldn't worry about him playing head games with KD as much, because when the Warriors offense is clicking, it's harder to carry yourself the way he's been carrying himself against the East.
Yeah, I mean, I think if we can come to an agreement that Cleveland's ability to win the finals is going to come down to whether their defense steps up. You know, like, if they're making these games competitive and they can make Golden State's offense work, they're going to have a chance. LeBron's going to get into the zone. That's their chance to win the series. If they don't, and they're getting, you know, picked apart because Golden State's passing on them like they pass on everybody else, then it's not going to matter.
All right, one more question out west. Andre says, do you guys have a favorite player to watch in the playoffs right now? For me, it's got to be Kawhi. Kawhi is a good option. He's been great, man. Honestly, my reaction to this, though, was my least favorite player to watch in the playoffs, and that is James Harden.
I knew it.
The foul stuff just drives me insane because his game is so pretty, and then at least once a quarter, he flops or initiates contact in a way that is so obnoxious, it's impossible to enjoy anything else about his game.
So which of the fouls exactly are you upset about? And the one that I've seen that's been getting a little bit more attention is when he basically hooks the defender's arm, like he brings his left arm up under the defender's arm, getting into his shooting motion, even if he doesn't have the ball in that left hand. And that's really driving people crazy. Is that what you're talking about? Or is it more of just the general flopping?
What you described is part of it. And I also, it drives me insane when he's coming around a screen and a big man is out hedging and he'll just throw himself at the big man and then hurl the ball at the rim and sometimes get three shots. Although I think one of the issues with Harden in the playoffs historically has been that like, the refs start to have less patience for some of that stuff. And you saw it in game two against San Antonio where like there were some times where he was actually getting hit and they just weren't blowing the whistle. So that it's kind of like his best weapon also sort of turns into kryptonite a little bit in the playoffs.
Man, that game two was what I thought the series was going to be. Remember, I was way too quick with my apology for being completely wrong because San Antonio looked so much different in game two in terms of controlling Houston's perimeter attack, in terms of controlling the pace, Kawhi getting off, having enough supporting help. And when people are looking at this Tony Parker move, I think Parker's injury definitely impacts San Antonio's ability in a series against, say, Golden State, where like points are really hard to come by. You've got to have those initiators and kind of getting into the defense and setting other guys up. And it can't just be all on Kawhi. But when I look at the rest of this series, I think they're going to miss Tony, but I don't think it's like a backbreaker. Like, I don't think it really changes that much in terms of what their percentages are to beat Houston. Like, they're either going to beat Houston because they control things like they did in game two, or they're going to lose because they completely lose control like they did in game one. I'm not sure how much Parker affects that either way.
Yeah, Josiah actually sent in a question about Tony Parker and why Andrew is always ragging on him for how bleak he is. It's not that, like, Tony Parker, when his game is on, it's fantastic. It's just that, like, for the last couple of years, there have always been these sort of predictable issues in the playoffs because he's just not all there athletically anymore at a time when every other team, every other contender has, like, tremendous options in the backcourt. And it's been, like, a real Achilles heel for the Spurs. And it's why, like you said, like, I don't know if Patty Mills is that much of a drop-off because he gives them more sort of energy and bounce back there as they try to deal with Patrick Beverley. Granted, if the Spurs knew that they were getting like B-plus to A-plus games from Tony Parker, like obviously that's a huge loss, but he's kind of hit or miss in some of these games.
Real quick for Josiah's question, I mean, I want to psychoanalyze you and myself here as well. I mean, the reason why you would describe somebody as like Tony Parker as bleak is because he's over 30 and his best years were 3 or 4 years behind him. That's sort of where we are at life right now, probably.
Well, not only that, and he's really good and it's really hard to watch him be reduced to this borderline unplayable option in the play. Like if they were to win this series and let's say Tony Parker were still healthy, like he would have been pretty dicey against the Warriors too. And it's kind of just a bummer to watch that play out every spring.
Totally. And that's the way I framed it coming into the postseason was like, when were the vultures going to come for Tony Parker? And I'm really sad that it happened in a season-ending injury type of way, but that was how you had to frame San Antonio's postseason run here, is like eventually he was going to be a big-time weak link. And it's hard to appreciate his greatness when it's not, you know, it's just a fraction of what it was, you know, even only 3 or 4 years ago. And when this team just never quite felt like it had that super high ceiling, you just inevitably look back to what the better days were. At least I do, because they weren't that long ago. And because, you know, I remember them probably as fondly as Josiah does. I mean, like 2013-14 Spurs, those were some awesome, really fun teams. And he was right in the middle of all of it.
All right, let's move on to a brighter topic than Tony Parker's demise. This is a question for me. Are you going to be purchasing a pair of the new Lonzo Ball exclusive from Big Baller Brand?
Oh, man. I got to admit, I'm of a split mind here. You know, I know that's that might be shocking.
Well, This is something people might not know about you, is that you're like on the low kind of a sneakerhead. So I know you have takes on the Lonzo shoes.
Okay, look. So on the one side, there's the fact that they're retailing for $495, which is
which is amazing. I cannot believe they did that.
And yet after it happened, it was entirely predictable, right? So these shoes are basically more expensive than like except the most premium rare Jordan exclusives.
Right.
They interestingly kind of set off a battle between like Nike fans and Adidas fans in terms of like which shoe company Big Baller Brand ripped off more for the design. It was like, no, they look like they've got the Adidas Boost. No, they look like the Kobe's. Like there was like an argument in terms of like which copyrights they infringed the most.
Yeah.
Somebody else came at the logo. Like apparently his logo copies some Ohio State logo. So there was a lot going on, right? And worst of all, obviously, was LeVar's comments when he's basically saying, like, look, if you can't afford my shoes, you're not a real big baller, which...
Hold on. I kind of loved that, though. That was a great way to spin it.
That's terrible. Look,
it's called Big Baller Brand. It's only for the ballers. Deal with it, America.
Look, part of me just hates the idea that he's going to shame anyone in poverty who can't afford it. And there's like real crime that happens over shoes all across the country in all sorts of different areas, riots at malls, shootings. We've seen it. The idea you would pander to that to try to exploit these communities really bothers me, right? Like that's one side of me. Okay. But there is another side of me here.
Okay. Thank God.
Did you see the promotional video that Slam put out?
I did not know. Wow, there's a video that accompanied these shoes?
Okay, so yeah, first of all, let's just put aside the fact that Lonzo in the video looks like a hostage along the line of like Melania Trump. I mean, there's a lot of that vibe.
I think everyone on all sides of this conversation feels bad for Lonzo Ball. It's not fair that he's been thrust into the middle of this like social experiment.
Look, so put that aside. I mean, there's like 5 minutes of voiceover where, like, you know, off screen, LeVar might be pointing a gun at his head. We don't know.
Right.
Put that aside. The key part of the video that really pulled on my heartstrings was that it was filmed with a drone at Chino Hills State Park in California. There's an aerial shot of Lonzo, you know, running up the hill at Chino Hills State Park. And first of all, that's a great park, great wildflowers to take pictures of, lots of, you know, good, moderate, but not overly strenuous hikes. And you don't even have to get out of the car. You can drive and have a great time, see all sorts of different sites. But the drone footage. So, I mean, clearly, like, I'm used to being an influencer, you know, like, you know, you hear all these different things about, you know, how can you plug shoes? I know they put that drone footage in there just to kind of whet my appetite, try to get me to go to bigballerbrand.com and drop my $495 on a pair. I didn't do it. I'm not going to do it. To answer your question, I'm not going to buy the Lonzo Zoe 2 Primes, but they almost got me with the drone.
Yeah, you've got a soft spot. Real recognize real. Drone recognize drone. Yeah, I am with you. I'm not going to... You know what was amazing? So I saw that the $495 shoes, and then he had the optional signed ones that came in a glass case, and those were $995, which is incredible.
Yeah, but the glass case was included free, though.
That's true. It's not a bad deal, honestly, when you really break it down. But then they also had slides, like those, the just little flip-flops. And I was like, oh, that's cool. Well, at least they put in like an affordable option for everyone. Anyone out there who's just trying to rep the triple B's and get down with the Lonzo lifestyle. And then I saw at the Wizards game, I was talking about it with reporters, and a reporter was like, you know, those were like $240 sandals, which that to me is the most incredible detail of all. I don't know how anyone could possibly, maybe they're handmade by the other two Ball brothers, but like $240 for fucking sandals is unbelievable. So
look, you're gonna have to pay premium prices for the LaMelo cross stitching. Okay, look, and also, I hate to be the fact check guy here, but they're only $220. Okay,
$220. There you go. So check them out, man. The other thing is that now there are people saying like this is all part of LaVar Ball's plan, and that pricing things this way was a way to sort of guarantee publicity. And it's actually smart. And I maybe kind of buy that, but that only makes me loathe them more. Like, because there's a degree, like, there's an element to the LaVar Ball story where, like, he is playing all of us. And in that version of events, like, the only person you could possibly compare him to is Donald Trump, because he just understands media better than anybody. And that is super depressing, and we need to free Lonzo. I think your Melania comparison is spot on.
Okay, look, I have a little insight here because I used to work in a small business.
Okay.
So part of it is genius marketing from LaVar Ball, there's no question. But another part of it is just sort of the practical realities when you don't have scale. So, and you might have ever come across this if you bought t-shirts like for your, like an AAU yeah. team or, you know, whatever. Like the t-shirt price, if you're only buying 10 units, is like kind of high. And if you want to make any profit off them whatsoever, you have to have, you know, pretty high prices if you were going to sell them, right? Like the cost of unit, if you're mass producing them and selling thousands or tens of thousands, is going to come down very quickly, right?
Right.
The problem that he's got is that he has no idea what the demand for these shoes are going to be, right? So he's got to like think, we can't like press up like 10,000 of these because they're not going to sell. The only person who bought one apparently was Ocho Cinco, and I think he's only going to buy one pair. You can't count on Ocho Cinco to be buying a full run of these, right? So he's got to price them in such a way where he's not going to be taking a huge bath on them, which means they're probably literally like making these like a couple dozen or 100 at a time. And that's, I think, what's driving at least some of the price point. And, you know, once you get to the decision where it's like, look, this shoe is going to cost $300 if we're going to sell it because we're not making enough of them to really have a good margin, you might as well just go all out and sell them for $500 and just steal money from idiots, right? I mean, that's probably factoring into the decision there.
Yeah, why not? Go for it. Well, all right. So we've hit the end of our relevant basketball questions, although relevance of the Big Baller Brand social experiment is debatable. But so let's move on here. We've got a question from Flo Biden. For NBA players to take in a fight, how did neither of you pick Matt Barnes? Dude drove 95 miles to beat up Derek Fisher. That's an hour and a half. He definitely gets my vote. Also, instead of the cliche overtime for the final segment of the mailbags, why not call it the podium? It's at the end of the main content, but it's got all the little tidbits that everyone stays for. It's perfect. And you know what? It is perfect. This is now called the podium, the final 15 minutes of the mailbag. And the Matt Barnes point is a really good point. I can't believe both of us forgot Matt Barnes. The only other
First of all, if we're going to call this the podium, are you dressed in your very best Mack Weldon's? Like, did you get yourself like kind of put together for this? Because I certainly did. And look, I forgot Matt Barnes because I don't really want to answer this question. I don't want to imagine NBA players in violence or myself in violent situations. I already tried to do an all peacekeeper team and you ragged on me about that for 2 months. All right. So yes, I might've forgot about Matt Barnes's off-court incidents. I'm sorry, Flo. But look, I think we spent far too much time portraying these guys in a negative light. By the way, how awesome was Kelly Oubre tonight?
Yeah, I was going to say, I think we need to add Kelly Oubre to the conversation too. But yeah, we forgot Matt Barnes. We forgot Nene, who would be pretty phenomenal.
Oh, yeah. Jimmy Butler too.
Yeah,
I mean, Jimmy Butler went head to head with Nene and he was not afraid.
Yeah, I would want all those guys by my side. But my first pick is Kelly Oubre after tonight. He's got a little crazy in him.
Let me ask you a counter question here, though, real quick.
Okay.
Who would you less want if you were in a fight than Kelly Olynyk.
Oh man, it's hard to say.
He might be near the bottom, right? And like even Isaiah Thomas was kind of clowning on him. I don't know if you saw Isaiah's post game press conference, but
yeah, I was
his
there.
Reaction to Kelly Oubre kind of like picking on Olynyk was like, well, I guess you kind of choose who you want to start fights with, you know, basically implying that they're both soft and that's why Oubre went after him.
So, all right, I heard Isaiah say that. I didn't want to raise my hand to raise an objection, but I think that's misleading because Kelly Olynyk is known for some like semi-dirty plays and elbows flying everywhere every time he's on the court. So, sure, I'm sure he's a really wonderful guy off the court, but like the way he plays is kind of hazardous to everyone's health.
Yeah, well, maybe there's some stuff going down in Celtics practice that we don't know about. I mean, like yeah, maybe I'm Kelly's just saying, like really, really backing
me,
down from Isaiah.
That's all. It is what it is.
David, maybe Isaiah just pointed his finger like a gun in Kelly's face and he backed down. I mean, that easily could have happened.
Who knows? Who knows? I'm not sure where you're going with that one, but it is what it is.
Oh, you don't remember that?
No.
Oh, Isaiah, remember there's that whole like thing where Isaiah pointed his finger like a gun and is he going to get suspended? And Isaiah was like, I was just pointing, and it was this a minor kerfluffle like a couple months ago.
Yeah, well, look, we should all be...
It was a very intimidating action. That's all I'm saying.
We should all be a little bit more skeptical of the Celtics. That's all I can say. David says, huge fan of the podcast. I want to echo Ben's point that Utah is one of the most underrated travel destinations. I just spent a week out there visiting all five of the state's national parks. The trip was incredible.
Oh, I've done it too.
This is the closest way to Ben Golliver's heart. He also included like five or six photos from Utah to prove that he visited. They were not drone photos, though.
If you hit all five state parks, when you get to the last one, you can just say this one's for the thumb, okay? Like, it's a pretty good moment.
God, that's amazing. Here's one email. Andrew said, it's 3 a.m. and I'm listening to Tuesday's Open Floor. My 30-plus pickup basketball team had a four-team playoff tonight that finished at 11 p.m., so I begrudgingly decided to record my beloved Celtics game. I turn my phone off at 8 p.m. and pray that no one ruined the game for me. Luckily, no one did. I finished the game 2 hours ago and still can't sleep. Can any two Wizards guard Isaiah in a pick and roll? Blah, blah, blah. The only reason I included this question is because I did pretty much the exact same thing and had the exact opposite experience on Tuesday night. I had a prior commitment that I couldn't get out of, so I had to record the playoff game. And I put my phone on airplane mode for like 4.5 hours and finally came out of it at like midway through the third quarter as I was like fast forwarding my way through DVR. I was too weak to make it through the entire game without checking my phone. And the second I turned off airplane mode, I got a text message saying Isaiah 53 piece from one of my Seattle friends. And then it was just like, fast forwarding through to my doom, and it was probably the least enjoyable sporting experience I've had in like the last 3 or 4 years.
You know, I was meaning to ask you about this because when we picked the All Golliver and the All Sharp All Stars, I had this whole theory about like the Venn diagram where your dream player was somebody who was from Seattle, who was a bucket getter, and who didn't play defense, and like whoever was like right in the middle of that Venn diagram needed to be the captain of your team. Naturally, I picked Isaiah Thomas.
Right.
And here he was in game two, just absolutely slaying you, like just taking you out back behind the barn, you know, whatever else you want to say.
Yeah, man.
How did that feel? I mean, why didn't you mention this when we talked about Isaiah for like 20 minutes earlier? I mean, you were awful quiet. Like, isn't it this one of these Greek tragedies? I keep mentioning these, you know, Greek tragedies, whether it's Steve Kerr or Giannis. I mean, shouldn't we throw you in this Greek tragedy fables book?
It really is. The theme of the playoffs for you has been Greek tragedy, and it is pretty poetic that I will almost certainly meet my demise as a Wizards fan at the hands of a player who I'm naturally predisposed to love. And look, if the Celtics do win, I am going to turn into like the biggest Isaiah stan. It's going to be kind of unbearable on this podcast because it will be so much fun to root for him to take down the Cavs. But yeah, Tuesday night was was awful. Don't DVR sporting events because it always ends that way. There's never been a time where I've successfully DVR'd a game and come away from it being like, that was a great decision. I'm really glad I did that. Anyways, Austin says, I'm going to start off by saying that Sharp gets a lot of criticism he doesn't deserve in the mailbag, but there is one thing he does that I didn't really notice at first, but now it's driving me crazy. Every single discussion you have about a player or team's current form, or any time really, Sharp throws out these random time increments. For example, Dame has played exceptionally well and has for like the past 6 to 8 weeks. All right. The fair criticism there is I do say like far too much on this podcast. But look, Damian Lillard was good for he was great for exactly 6 to 8 weeks this year. So fuck off. That I feel pretty confident in the way in describing that time frame.
Like, I appreciate the attention to detail and like the passion from the listeners.
Yeah,
absolutely. you know, if we get people emailing in to say like, I've used the same Mac Weldon bit 6 times, I'm going to kind of chuckle and be like, well, that's good. You listened to all 6 of them. This might be a little bit too much parsing, man. Like, this is what I'm saying. These guys go too hard on you. Like, this is too much.
I don't know. That was a loving fuck off, by the way. So it's all good. I appreciate it. And we got another one. This one I was really excited about. Josiah, this was the second part of his question after the Spurs. He says, Ben, how on earth can a guy with an official Instagram checkmark only have 400 followers? Isn't that kind of embarrassing? You would think Insta would require X amount of followers before you even get the mark. You should do a giveaway or something.
I don't want to say I was courted by Facebook or Instagram and given the check mark when I had exactly one post and one follower. But that's exactly what happened. I think that's actually a badge of honor. Okay.
Yeah.
And if you're talking about my follower count,
you're an influencer. The Ball family is also courting you with the drones.
Look, bottom line, I had the check before I had the account, basically. And right. I've had the account for like 3 months. Isn't 400 a pretty like reasonable number?
Yeah, I don't really know how Instagram promotion works. I don't promote my account. I don't want to be verified on any social media. But I have faith in you to build your audience and to cultivate your brand. So just give him time, Josiah. It's only been a couple months. The drone has really only been operative for about a month now. I think it's a long off season. There's plenty of places to take this. Couple more here. D. Barton says, please get Sharp going on the Marcus played for Markeef conspiracy theory. That's right up his alley. I am too stressed out as a Wizards fan to laugh at stuff like that during the playoffs. I'm just a little too wound up right now. But sure, I can't believe they have the same tattoos. That part of it was incredible. Can I tell you one conspiracy theory that I heard tonight that was pretty entertaining?
You can. Please do.
So Nene left the Wizards and has been like showing out for the Rockets all year long. And it's hard to explain because he was really like kind of a shell of himself for the last year, maybe 2 years on the Wizards. And now he's like a real weapon for Houston. And
I mean, he got like 30% as much money as Al Jefferson. Al Jefferson couldn't even play in the playoffs.
Exactly.
So, yeah, he was a real shell.
Yeah. Well, and he's on a deal, I think 1 year for $3 million. And so anyways, I heard basically that part of the reason that this has happened is that Nene split up with his wife and got got in great shape. And number two, started using Instagram now more than ever and has been posting all these photos of himself in great shape, potentially courting people via social media. But bottom line is like he's really turned over a whole new leaf now as he's entered this new chapter of life and Houston is reaping the benefits.
Isn't this exactly what Lala just did the last 2 weeks?
Like, basically, Nene and Lala, yeah, they're both on the same page right now.
And their names are both four letters alternating vowels and consonants. Wow, we got to start like a Us Weekly rumor here. Like, oh, future matchmakers, Nene and Lala coming together.
Yeah, you know, make of it what you will. I'm just laying out the facts here. Although I'm not sure how much of that were actually facts, but it is what it is. All right, last
rampant
question.
Speculation, but hold on, though. I have a thing about the Markieff and Marcus.
Okay.
This is another one of these situations where if you don't pay attention to Las Vegas Summer League, you're missing a lot, okay? Not only do they have matching tattoos, which anyone who follows that should have known that, They also regularly wear matching outfits head to toe. Like when Marcus shows up at the Wizards games wearing Markieff's jersey and he's, you know, wearing jeans or whatever else, that's only because somebody told him he can't just show up in a Wizards uniform head to toe wearing the same shoes as Markieff. That would have been his preference. When they were at Summer League together, same jewelry, same watch, same t-shirt, same pants, same shoes. This is a real thing and it goes really, really deep. And what's also weird is that they've tried to recruit Thomas Robinson as the third triplet.
the lost Morris brother. That's amazing.
And no, it's true. And when they're all together, they also often will wear the same clothes. So that's just a little inside, inside scoop from Summer League. But
yeah, it's pretty weird.
I wasn't necessarily buying into the role reversal place, but I was really impressed that Keith played through that. Weren't you?
I'm still pretty impressed that he's playing through this. And that's the Markieff that started off the game in game two was great. And by the second half, he was basically like hopping around the court on one leg. The one thing that really, like, if I have one piece of advice for Markieff Morris, it's don't talk trash to Isaiah Thomas anymore. Like, you just don't need to stir up that hornet's nest. Like, Isaiah is kind of like a literal hornet on the court. And, don't screw around with him anymore. Talk trash to every other player on the Celtics.
People love making the Isaiah AI comparisons. And when Isaiah crossed Markieff and his leg just basically gave out because, you know, his ankle was bad. And then Isaiah just stared at him the whole way down the court. That was pretty much the Ty Lue moment of this postseason.
Yes.
You know?
And I mean, honestly,
he didn't quite step over him, but it was the same general impact.
Yeah, we're going to finish with an Iverson question here. Jason says, I live in Shangri-La, Yunnan Province, China, on the border of Tibet, 3,300 meters above sea level. Drive to a village north every week or so, 4,700 meters above sea level, while frequently listening to your podcast. Having said all that, to compare Westbrook to Iverson, not your finest moment. So
that's what you did, right?
I did. And I don't know, man. It is a toss-up at this point between whether it's Westbrook or Isaiah Thomas. Which one reminds you more of Allen Iverson?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, with the nature of their games, Iverson is not a good comp for Isaiah. Isaiah is so futuristic and so efficient in terms of how he's getting all of his buckets. Like, the real comp for Isaiah is Harden. And I keep going back to that, but like the way they're getting their points, that's basically who you're comping. We wouldn't comp Harden to Iverson, would we? Basically ever? I don't think.
Yeah.
So I don't really like that comp. In terms of Westbrook versus Iverson, to me, that's not a basketball thing so much as a swag thing, right? Or personality or anti-establishment vibe. I mean, Iverson took it to greater extremes in terms of how he dressed and carried himself and all of that. But in terms of like the rebel without a cause who underdogs love to root for,
right?
I think that's where you're going with Westbrook and Iverson, right?
Yeah, a little bit. And Jason added, the retrospective downgrading of Iverson's skills and impact on the league has been sad to see and smells of marketing agendas and mediocrity. It's a great take. And look, I hate people who downgrade Iverson's skills. I think people who watched him can testify to the impact that he had. And yet there are areas of the game where he really does not grade out well, like statistically. And that to me is the part of the Westbrook experience that is super analogous, because people are going to be talking about Westbrook in 10 years and there are going to be a lot of people who point to his record and say, look, he was never as good as people said. And then there are going to be all kinds of other people who say, look, I watched this guy. He was incredible. You just had to be there. And that's why Westbrook and Iverson, I'm not downgrading either one of them. I think they're both incredible in a specific way that isn't totally conducive to winning, but is cool enough that you are compelled to sometimes say, fuck winning. And it doesn't really matter because they're just that fun. I do think.
Well, look, I called Westbrook the martyr ball guy, right? I mean, Iverson was an original martyr ball
Iverson
guy,
and I think that's why martyr ball.
For sure. And I think that's why, you know, his fans are going to be more diehard than almost any other player's fans, right? I mean, that's kind of how it works. That's why we call it martyr ball. I do think, and I don't want to sound like I'm downgrading Iverson. I was a huge Iverson fan. I went to see him when I was in college, you know, made the drive up from Baltimore to Philly just to like have that in-person experience.
Right.
I remember sitting way up in the nosebleeds and just loving it. I mean, it was a great basketball experience. I think ultimately his influence on the next generation of guys in terms of how they played and how important ball handling was is going to wind up being bigger than his own individual impact. If that makes sense. Like, I think his influence on this entire generation of guards that, you know, basically has swarmed the league here over the last like 8 to 10 years is going to have longer lasting impacts than himself on the court.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, not to play the rings card, but like made the finals once, you know, kind of did it his way. He admits he was unbending. He admits he should have been more coachable. There's different things he could have done. He is going to get glossed over by history. The further history goes out in terms of his on-court accomplishments, because the things that most people judge, he doesn't stack up that hot.
Yeah, no, I that's actually a pretty smart point. I think he did impact the way people view the guard position, and that is going to be sort of a lasting legacy. I also think that a lot of people in today's generation learned how not to be a superstar from watching Allen Iverson. And like the people who followed him, whether it was LeBron in 03, basically LeBron deserves a ton of credit for ushering in just a much healthier version of the NBA. And I don't think LeBron has talked at length about how much he respects Iverson. But he clearly went about things a different way, which I think was for the best. The only other thing I wanted to say is that Isaiah is the first guy who, like, he leaves you in disbelief the same way Iverson did, and just in terms of the way he's sometimes creates around the rim and like the guys he scores over. And so I think all of the best parts of watching Iverson come through in Isaiah's best games.
Yeah, and you could say the same thing too for Westbrook. I mean, you got swept up. You gave him your MVP vote because you got swept up on a fun couple of weeks there, and it was very Iversonian in terms of, you know, taking every big shot, having everything go through him, incredible feats of athleticism you didn't think were possible,
right?
Just jaw dropping moment after jaw dropping moment. Like, you get some of that too, but I don't think either one of them is a perfect comp. You know, and I think, you know, just to be even mentioned or kind of like, you know, glancingly compared to Iverson is a gigantic compliment. I think that's sort of what Jason was going for, right? It's like, let's respect Iverson here, and hopefully we've done that.
Yeah. Well, thank you to all our listeners in the Yunnan province. And thank you to anyone who made it this far in the mailbag, everyone who submitted questions. It's now close to 2 a.m. on a Thursday night, so it's definitely time to shut this down. But fun pod and fun playoffs. I'm excited to see where the Celtics-Wizards series goes.
I'm excited to check my mail tomorrow to see if I got an influencer kit from Big Baller Brand. I'll cross my fingers on that one. Hey, Andrew, we got to tell them. 5-star reviews on iTunes. Send all questions to openfloormail@gmail.com. I'm enjoying these playoffs. I know you are as well. At least you're pretending to after being so upset earlier when the Wizards weren't winning that you were ready to turn your back on the entire sport. I don't think I've forgotten that.
Kelly Oubre brought me back to life tonight.
openfloormail@gmail.com. Send us your pictures of Bryce Canyon. Send us your altitude heights. Send us your Mack Weldon sweatpant, fashion shoots, whatever you're up to, let us know. Andrew, I'll talk to you next week.
All right, man. Take it easy.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.
Another great edition of Open Floor is in the books. Did you know Locked On has a daily podcast for all 30 NBA teams? If you're a Lakers fan, search Locked On Lakers. A Celtics fan, search Locked On Celtics. Warriors fans, search Locked On Warriors. Yes, all 30 NBA teams have a daily bite-sized podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team.
It's the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.